My name is Corinne Sullivan, and I serve as the Assistant Dean of Curriculum at the School of Medicine at UNLV, and that's the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, in the United States. And what I do is basically I oversee the four Fs, so facilities, funding, faculty, and feedback. So I run the day-to-day operations. So every planned encounter with the teacher or simulation activity or lab goes through my office to ensure that students have optimal learning experiences and encounters that contribute to patient care and patient safety. And so I run that. A lot of what we do in medical education is we do 2 years of basic science and work with simulation labs and technology downstairs. So doctors get to practice on mannequins and all kinds of like materials and suturing and lots of skills before they actually touch patients. And in their third and fourth year, they do their clinical training in which they round at local hospitals and our affiliated clinics to learn a little bit more about patient care and then graduate and become resident doctors. And eventually get their licensing to practice medicine in the United States. And I'm so excited to be here this morning with you.
Well, good. Did you rehearse that? That was So we'll jump right into some student questions. You guys, great questions so far that you emailed to me. Again, feel free to message any in the chat if you would like to ask yourself to Dr. Sullivan. One of the kids want to know, what role does student feedback play in shaping your curriculum at your medical school?
Great question. So we are a new school. So we've only been open for about 7 years. So student feedback is essential. And you have multiple means by which you can get feedback when you're in school, and that's directly to the instructor, the professor. We also do end of course evaluations. And then I'm also downstairs during activities to watch your progress and performance, as well as be there to answer any questions or if there's concerns shared. I usually take that information back. And what we do is we also have surveys and town halls where students can express what they don't like as well as what they like. And so when we're doing that, we look more at performance scores. Back in the day, we used to test students and do like a quantifiable type of metric. So if you pass exams, we didn't worry about you. If you were doing all right in terms of scoring and performance, nowadays it's kind of a multi-form assessment. So really, it's word on the street and encounters. And then we also do documented feedback when it comes to your course evaluations. But students are paramount. When you go to a school, especially a medical school or any type of professional school, we want to make sure that you're getting what you need. So we do all kinds of feedback and assessment plans to make sure that we're giving you what you need, that you enjoy your experience at this school. And it's a little bit more different when you get into graduate school, which medical school and law school and some of the graduate programs are. That we really do take it seriously, and we do take that like administrator to patient contact. So what you say matters. So I always tell students, when you have this type of voice and this type of authority at the school, that to be careful what you complain about, think about what you really need, because we see when we hear you. So things that you don't like, we'll make immediate changes about. So to be very careful when you give feedback that it's actually to benefit you in the program.
One of our kids in the States emailed me, and they wanted to know, in your opinion, what is the biggest challenge facing higher education leadership today?
Wow, that's a great question. I have to say, more and more, leadership is becoming more administrative. So rather than have people who've actually practiced in the field and have a lot of that life experience and can anticipate things when they don't go right, that seems to be kind of experiential type of thing that I have concerns about. A lot of the administrators that we have in terms of people who work within the role of a school don't have a lot of that life experience. So we do recruit a lot of clinicians and individuals to come teach. And I think that with leadership, we're starting to reflect more of an administrative role rather than people who've had actual hands-on active experience. And also, there's always going to be inside politics and influence. People, when they come in and have leadership roles, sometimes they have their own agenda. And at times when you're in a large school, especially when you're running medical education programs, we bring in a good amount of revenue because we hire the physicians to practice. And whenever you bring in money and authority and you have departments that may make more money than other departments, for example, surgery will take in a lot more money than a family medicine practice. So when you get into higher roles, Oftentimes, sometimes the surgeons have a greater voice because they can bring in greater revenue. Doesn't make it right. It just makes it a little bit more of the political landscape. And so we put checks and balances in place. So I would definitely say we don't have enough experience. And sometimes politics get into play when you have to deal with funding and other kind of economical things.
Interesting, interesting. We have a question from Mark in Catalonia. Mark,
Ooh.
all the way in Catalonia, go ahead and unmute and ask.
Did you any time a student participated in any operation or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. So when they're a third-year student, students can actively participate in surgery. It's always under the supervision of a licensed professional, and they'll know your learning level. So if you're on a rotation in the hospital and say you're on surgery, they will wait a couple weeks before they let you into the theater, which is basically the operating room. And at first they'll let you like hold clamps. They'll never let you do the opening cut. You have to wait for to do those types of things when you're a resident after you graduate medical school. But yeah, absolutely. Sometimes they have them hold the clamps open. You do a lot of suturing in medical school, so you do a lot of sewing and lots of observation, and you are allowed in the operating room, and then physicians will make the determination of what level of learner you are to participate in the surgery. But we've had some really phenomenal stories at the School of Medicine here at UNLV. Your first 6 weeks are immersed in emergency medicine. So we've had some great stories where we have students on overnight call. So they work the overnight shift and their attending physician is out or attending to another patient. And our students have had to come in to do life-saving measures or to answer a code red or unresponsive patient. So you have enough skills to resuscitate someone, but yeah, you actively participate in the practice of medicine when you're a third and fourth year student in medical school in the United States and Canada, of course.
Oh wow! Thank you for that.
Yeah.
The kids studied quite a bit about your bio. One of the kids from France emailed me. What lessons did you learn from receiving the National Florence Hood Minor Scholarship that have kind of shaped your career?
Oh, that award's a lot about grit and resilience. And so in my life, and I'm sure many of yours, it hasn't been always an easy road, and there's things that happen to you, and you might have some confidence checks, and you always have that fear factor. You don't want to fail, and you don't want to mess up. You always want to try to make the best decision and do the right thing. But I think that I've been really resilient when I've tried to pursue things and they haven't worked out. I had a dream of becoming a doctor. I couldn't get into medical school, so I rerouted. I took a different path. And I said, you know what? What if I work to get on the other side and I could have a hand in training students who will someday help a patient or save someone's lives? Maybe that's my role. So being resilient and having a little bit of grit, and when things don't go your way, you just change course and you forgive yourself and you learn and you grow. And I always think that there's some sort of algorithm in the universe, or there's something in which you always land where you're supposed to be. Even if you have different dreams and intentions, you always end up where you're supposed to be. And whether that be to help someone else or to help your family or to grow, that's definitely something that I've learned. And that scholarship was all from grit and resilience when I just wouldn't give up because I wanted to learn. I wanted to be somewhere. I saw the goal, and no matter what happened, I wanted to get there. So having grit and being able to forgive yourself and try not to judge yourself too much, especially when things don't go well.
Very good advice. Very good advice. So we're going to jump kind of all over the place a little bit because the kids studied a
Great.
little bit about your background as an entrepreneur. So you started a non-alcohol alternative. The kids wanted to know what inspired you to start that. Was there a connection for medical regarding, all the alcohol related like diseases and stuff like that out there?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I came to Las Vegas, I was originally at the University of Washington, Seattle, where I got trained. And then when I came to Las Vegas, I really studied the map and the hospital map. I wanted to see what people suffered from in Las Vegas. And at the time, there was a large hospitality medicine. So people who were going to the ER were dehydrated, they had fallen and had like lacerations and some really traumatic injuries. And I was wondering, how come there's so many patients in who have like split lips, who had fallen? There was alcohol intoxication, sunstroke. Never seen such numbers. And I learned that it was from the intake of alcohol. and the abuse of alcohol. A lot of people come to Las Vegas to have a wonderful time. There's a huge entertainment industry here. There's great music and there's a wonderful nightlife scene, and people go to the restaurants and they drink a lot of alcohol. And given my knowledge of medicine, alcohol is a toxin and it is something that's socially accepted in terms of celebration. So when I was seeing all these numbers, I was like, there has to be a better way. And especially in the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, why isn't there an alternative for people who don't want to drink but still kind of want a sophisticated beverage, a sophisticated adult beverage? And I should probably make it. And then I was also thinking when I would do rotations on the oncology ward, the cancer ward, a lot of people in there who are getting radiation have juice, sugary juice, and things to drink. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun when you're going through something that you could have a really nice drink that has no alcohol but has hydration and health benefits? So that all kind of contributed to this idea. Hey, I'm going to start Lotel. So Lotel's the name, Lotel Libations. I'm going to start a low calorie, non-alcoholic, zero proof cocktail brand. And I'm in the backyard of it. I think that maybe it's something that could happen. And so I wrote the business plan and made a prototype with recipes and then tried to see if I could sell it. And once I started selling them, that's when I was like, well, I have proof of concept, which is a business term of your product has validity in the market and people will buy it. And I have to tell you, in whatever you decide to do, if you decide to do entrepreneurship or open up business or a product line or pursue AI technology, which is huge, when you talk to venture capital firms, they want to see proof of concept. Can you sell it? Do people buy it? So that's how the idea stemmed, was just my move here.
It's good though. So it's translating into saving lives and helping people. So good for you. We're excited to learn more about that. So we have Christopher from Spain. You had an awesome question, pal. Go ahead and ask. Might be some technical issues. Christopher wanted to know what careers can you pursue to when you reach your level of education? Like what different careers can you pursue?
Oh, well, of course, you could always pursue education. You could always teach. You can consult. In my field, I can teach some minor skill labs and do special labs and special sessions. I've also, you could write. I could be an author and write. Whenever you have a degree, it gives you some sort of authority if you have the degree and the experience. But you could do technology and innovation. So I work with a lot of students on research projects. When you go into the graduate level and PhD, you learn how to do methods of research, and that translates into bench research, lab research, qualitative research, all kinds of research. So you learn how the practice of that. You could work in public policy. You could do sampling of populations to make recommendations for health policy. So it's a nice kind of background to have, especially if you decide that you want to pursue school. I have to tell you, I think I had a great time. I loved going to school, so getting a PhD was very natural to me. I loved learning. I loved listening to really smart, talented people, so it was a natural path for me. But you can be successful with or without the degree. If you learn how to self-study and you know how to self-study and how to learn, that's very powerful, that you don't necessarily need to go to an institution to be successful.
Interesting, fascinating. That kind of like touches on one of the questions sent from Canada. One of the kids wanted to know what are the biggest challenges that you guys have at the Kikkorian School of Medicine when it comes to curriculum and aligning with national standards?
Oh, wonderful. Well, the great thing about medical school is there's some flexibility when it comes to requirements because, in different contexts throughout the country, people suffer from different things because environmental health is a very real thing. And, people who live in certain areas may be subject to environmental exposures or things that make them sick, and that's different all around the world. So, what we do is you really do kind of an idea, you draw your curriculum where you're based. And then you have to fall under the requirements of, does this meet patient health standards given that we're looking at this sort of population of patient given where they live? So it's a little tricky. And especially in the very beginning, we didn't have a lot of funding. So when it came to classroom space, a lot of that was just asking the university for spaces and seeing where we could teach and then utilizing those funds for equipment and for teachers. So it gets a little tricky. It's loosely based. If you are in the United States, may get a federal law, but the states can interpret it. It's very much the same when you come into medical programs that are accredited by national bodies. They give you the federal guidelines, and then given your state, you have a reasonable jurisdiction to determine how that's applied. And then the site visitors will come every 4 years to make sure that there's a good standard of care and that you've interpreted it in a way that's positive and reflects some positive health outcomes for your community. But that's a great question. It gets tricky because you have like a blanket statement, but it's going to mean different things and it's going to be created and implemented in different ways depending where you're located within the United States.
Right. Thank you for
Yeah.
sharing. We have a couple more student questions. I'm gonna let you go. Mark, go ahead. You had another question. Go ahead and ask from Catalonia.
Yes, thanks. What is the funniest or surrealist anecdote you had with anyone in the hospital?
It might have been hard to hear it. He wanted to know, do you guys have any funny anecdotes from dealing with any patients or students in the hospital?
Oh yeah, so we have stuff where we're at where patients don't want to be treated, so they'll be in bed and then we'll close the curtain and then we'll see them sneaking out the hospital, or we'll see them outside, and sometimes the gowns are open and they're just kind of sitting around, or they call an Uber or someone to pick them up. We've had students, of course, who, will dress up like other doctors and they have a lot of fun like that. But I think the most silly ones is when the patients don't want to have care and they're very calm. They don't really want to sit in the hospital and wait, so they leave and they're still in their gown. That's my favorite. And we're trying to track them down and they're just sitting there waiting for their Uber, or they're gonna walk home and in their little hospital gown. I think that's the funniest stuff too, because you're like, how did they get out of there? Why are they walking around? It's just a cloth gown. So that's the silliest.
There's a hospital near my house. I go jogging and I've seen, like, I don't know if they're doctors, but they're in scrubs, like off to the side smoking cigarettes out on the side.
Yes. Oh yes, that oh yes. Yes, that happens too. I know.
Maybe they didn't get the email that smoking's bad for you.
Yeah, I don't know.
Two more student questions. We have Patricia, and Patricia, go ahead and unmute to ask. You're in Europe.
My question is, what was your goal when you started your career?
Oh, wonderful question. My goal, I really wanted to become a doctor because I was really interested in people. I call myself a people enthusiast, so I really liked people, and I thought, oh, wow, what a wonderful job. I could actually learn about people and take care of them. And if I'm a really good doctor, I could take care of their family. So I could see the whole scope of life and be like a generational doctor and know everybody. And when I got into higher ed, medical school, law school, as you guys are very top performers. It's very hard to get into schools and there's limited seats. And when you're dealing with really talented students across the country, it's hard to get those seats and get those opportunities to go to medical school and so forth. So that was ultimately my goal. And I rerouted a little bit. So I ended up working in a medical school and working with doctors. So it worked itself out in a roundabout way. And I did become a doctor, only I'm a PhD doctor. So I can talk to you, write really long papers, and do any kind of research and methods you like. May not be able to save a life, but I could give you the research to help you make good decisions to do that. But yeah, that's ultimately my goal. And I don't feel like I failed. I just feel like I took a little bit of a reroute because things just didn't work out.
That's great. And it seemed that it all worked out. It all worked out there.
Yeah.
So I always ask this of all of our guests. This is the final question. What advice would you give to these kids as they go off into the world and figure out what kind of path they want to lead, whether it has to do in your field or a completely different field?
Yeah, I encourage you to travel and to meet people, talk to a lot of people, learn what you like to do and what your passion is. And sometimes the best way to do that is by doing things that you find out you don't like doing. And don't be afraid to disappoint anybody. Try to always focus on what makes you happy. And that could be anything. And don't worry about other people's expectations of you. Just go your own path. Make sure that you're happy and that you really love what you do, whatever that may be, regardless of the income source or where you find yourself. Don't be afraid to take chances. And when things don't work out, don't be afraid to get back up and just keep on going. Just never give up. Always move forward. You don't have to lead. You don't have to follow, but just always keep moving forward and look out for yourself too. It's okay to look out for yourself.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. And before I end the meeting for all guys, we have a lot of great guest speakers on the horizon. Please check them out. Rapper Curtis Blow, one of the creators of rap music. and actor Gary Sinise, and we'll have a few other CEOs, and just sign up by the end of the year. It'll be fun. We're looking forward to seeing you guys. But before we go, I'm going to ask everyone to unmute. Can we say thank you to Dr. Corinne Sullivan for taking the time out of her day to talk to us today? Thank you so much for talking to us. We appreciate you
Thank
greatly.
you.
Oh,
Thank
thank you.
you.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.